Monday, 22nd of July. Walking the children to school the next morning feels surreal. The air is cool and green, and she has thrown on a jacket over her summer clothes. The streets teem with children in sky blue and navy. Alex stares at them keenly. None of them has a father who went missing this weekend. 10 minutes after she gets home, she notices she has a missed call from a number she doesn't recognize. She Googles the number and feels a jolt of nervous energy surge all the way through her when she sees that it is the number for a hotel just off Tottenham Court Road. And then a wave of relief passes through her. She pictures Nathan waking up after the biggest bender yet, rubbing his eyes, looking at the time, realizing that he's been out cold for 48 hours, looking for his phone, discovering it was out of charge, using the hotel's landline to call her, and everything falls into place. She calls the number back immediately, with slightly shaking hands. "Hi," she says briskly to the young-sounding woman who answers the phone. "I think it's possible that my husband just called from this number, Nathan Summer. Is he staying there?" There's a tiny pert silence, and then the young woman says, "Oh, hi. Is this Alex Summer?" "Yes," she says. "Yes, I am. How did you know my name?" "Well, actually, it was me that just called you, Mrs. Summer. I'm really sorry. I didn't know what else to do, but Mr. Summer was here this weekend, and unfortunately, after he failed to check out this morning, we used the master key to let ourselves into his room and found quite a lot of damage. We found his business card in the room, and we tried calling him a few times on his mobile, but it kept going to voicemail, and so I called his office number just now to see if I could get hold of him that way, but they said he hadn't come into work today, and they gave me your number, and I hope you don't mind me calling you like this." Alex freezes, while scenarios spool wildly through her head. Finally, she says, "No, of course not. But we will have to charge Mr. Summer for the damage to his room, I'm afraid." "Sorry, can you just explain what happened, blow by blow, because I'm afraid I don't really understand." "Oh, yes, sure," the young woman responds brightly. "Mr. Summer checked in here on Saturday night, quite late. His companion told us that she'd paid online for 2 nights." "Companion?" "Yes, the person he was with." "And who was that?" "I'm afraid I don't know. I wasn't working on Saturday night, but the room had been prepaid for 2 nights. Mr. Summer seems to have left at some point on Sunday without checking out. Nobody saw him leave, and we have no record of it. And when we went to his room this morning to request that he vacate it, it was empty. No sign of Mr. Summer or his companion. And the room, I'm afraid, was trashed."
"Trashed?"
"Yes, and we're going to need to take some sort of payment to cover the costs, I'm afraid. And since his companion's card is being declined and we are unable to contact Mr. Summer, we'd be very grateful if you could help us to sort out this issue."
"The room," says Alex. "My husband's room, has it been tidied yet? Has it been cleaned?"
"No, we're waiting for management to send over a specialist cleaning team. It hasn't been touched."
"Okay. Well, I'd like to see it, please, because my husband hasn't come home. He's disappeared, and maybe there might be something in the room that explains where he is, where he's gone. Please, I can be there in half an hour."
There is a short silence while the young woman goes to ask her manager and then comes back on the line.
"Sure, that'll be fine. We'll see you in half an hour."
The receptionist hands Alex the key.
"It's room 18, she says, "on the first floor, down there and up the stairs."
Alex heads down the corridor and up a narrow staircase. Room 18 is the second door on the left. She touches the card to the panel and it clicks open. The curtains are drawn and her eyes take a moment to adjust to the dark before she finds the slot for the key card and activates the lighting, and it all comes to full and shocking life. The room has been ransacked. The bedding has been pulled virtually completely off the bed so that the mattress is visible.
and the duvet is hanging half on the floor. The minibar has been drunk dry. There are empties all over the floor. The remains of a McDonald's takeaway are scattered everywhere. Ketchup-smeared paper packaging and greasy bags of cold fries. Alex picks her way gingerly across the chaos and towards the bathroom. Here, there are wet towels on the floor, empty mixer cans in the sink, and there... Alex's stomach turns violently. Women's underwear. A thong made of cheap lace, removed and left discarded on the floor. Blonde curly hairs in the sink. A smear of tinted lip gloss on the rim of a glass. And the smell, just the sheer, unmistakable smell of a woman everywhere in the air. Alex sits on the side of the bath and stares about herself. She stands up slowly and peers into the bin, looking for clues. Back in the bedroom, she starts to see more than a drunken sexual interlude playing out in this room. She sees a picture hanging crooked on the wall, a crack in its glass. She sees a table lamp knocked onto its side. The bedside table is turned at a 90-degree angle to the wall. And there, she sees, as she crouches lower and lower to the wooden floor, is a small smudge of what looks at first like Marmite, maybe, or ketchup from the McDonald's, but comes away on the tip of her finger as bright scarlet blood. She winces at the sight of it and stands up so quickly that blood rushes to her head. She turns in a circle, trying to find more answers to the thousand questions that flood her mind from the detail of the room. But there is nothing. A fight, a girl, food, drink, a discarded thong. Alex sits on the edge of the pillaged bed and gets out her phone. She calls Nathan and it goes to voicemail. She goes back down to reception, and when she talks to the young woman at the desk, she realizes she is crying. "Please," she says, "please, I need to see your records. I need to see your CCTV footage. My husband has disappeared and I don't know where he is, and I can't take another day like this. I can't take another day of this not knowing. Please." The receptionist smiles nervously and says, "Let me ask my manager. Give me a minute." A moment later, a glamorous woman with dyed black hair appears from the office behind the front desk. Her name badge says Astrid Pagano, and she has intricate black tattoos up both her forearms. "Please," she says in a soft accent, "come with me." She beckons her into the back office and Alex follows. It's a tiny room and they are squashed together in front of the security monitors, elbow to elbow. "I am sorry," says Astrid. "So sorry that you are having a difficult time. Let's see if we can find you some answers." It takes a few minutes to find what they're looking for. The date stamp on the screen says Sunday, 1:41 a.m. First of all, she sees Nathan and a pretty blonde woman approaching the hotel. This must be Caitlin, she assumes, the girl Giovanni told her about. She looks older than Alex had imagined. She has a mass of blonde curly hair tied away from her face in a ponytail, and very soft features. She wears white jeans and white trainers, and a loose black halter neck top and big gold earrings, and looks like a goddess. Nathan, bringing up her rear, looks ridiculous in comparison. He can barely put one foot in front of the other, and has to clutch the wall as he reaches the front door to stop himself from falling over. The footage moves to another screen, and here Alex watches Nathan stumbling around behind Caitlin as she checks them in. She has seen Nathan drunk many, many times, but never as drunk as he appears to be in this footage. Then they disappear from the screen, heading darkly towards the staircase at the back of the hotel. Astrid forwards through the next couple of hours, and then pauses, and slows the footage again at around 3 a.m. There is Nathan. He's dressed and still stumbling. He bangs into the console table opposite the front desk and then pauses for a moment and takes his phone out of his pocket.
He switches it on and frowns at it, swaying slightly on the spot as he tries to focus on the screen. Then he puts the phone back in his pocket and heads out the front door. Now they move to the second monitor, and there he is. There's Nathan out in the dark street, glowing briefly under the direct light of a street lamp and then turning into shadows again as he moves away. He is lit up by the approaching headlights of a car and he turns, almost losing his footing as he does so. He shields his eyes briefly with the back of his hand and then smiles and waves. The car pulls up to the left of the hotel, just visible in shot. Nathan weaves his way from the hotel entrance down the pavement and then gets to the passenger door of the car. Alex watches him as he goes to open the door and then he stops and stares at the driver. Appears to change his mind about getting in the car, but turns back, maybe as the driver says something to him, and a moment later he climbs in. Then the car slowly pulls away, and the street is cast in darkness once more. "Recognize the car?" asks Astrid. Alex shakes her head. "Can we rewind a little bit to just as it arrives? There," she says. "Pause it just there." Astrid hits the pause button on the screen, and there is the registration plate, fully legible. Astrid hands Alex a piece of paper and a pen, and Alex writes it down. "Maybe it's an Uber," Astrid suggests. Alex shakes her head. "No," she says. "Nathan would never get in the front seat of an Uber. He always gets in the back." It looked like he was expecting to know the driver, and then he didn't. But he got in anyway. Her voice trails away. None of it makes any sense. Whose car did he think he was getting into? Who was he expecting to see at 3 in the morning? Whose message had he seen on his phone before he left? Astrid is about to shut down the footage, but Alex stops her. "Can I see her leaving, please? The woman. Is that okay?"
"Yes, of course."
And there is Caitlin, a few seconds later, looking cool and put together. No visible sign of whatever had happened between her and Nathan in the trashed hotel room. Not a hair out of place. Her jeans, still a pristine white. But just as she passes the front desk, Alex sees it. A red, raw scratch all down the side of her cheek. Caitlin turns again, and it's gone. But Alex doesn't ask Astrid to pause it this time. She doesn't want to see it again. She doesn't want to know. "The name of the woman who made the booking, do you know who it was? Was it her, Caitlin?" Astrid flicks screens to the hotel's booking system and clicks some buttons.
"Okay," she says. "So the booking was made via a booking engine earlier in the day, and no, the booking wasn't made in the name of Caitlin."
She stops and inhales audibly.
"And I really shouldn't be telling you this, as I'm sure you know, but I'm the boss today, and I can see that this is important, so..."
She turns back to the screen and clicks another button.
"I can see that the booking was made in your husband's name, but paid for with a card in someone else's name. The name on the card..."
She turns to Alex and nods just once, as if she already knows something. "Was Miss Erin Jade Fair?"
"So, Josie called me shortly after us chatting at Stitch, after I gave her my number and she told me she had a gig. And the gist, apparently, was to catch out her friend's husband in the act of infidelity. Apparently this guy had been sleeping around for years. Yeah, men, right? And this woman refused to believe the evidence of her own eyes and ears. And Josie just wanted her friend to know, to see, to start believing what her husband was capable of. I said, no, I don't think so. I am not actually a call girl, you know. I'm an actor." "She said, you don't have to sleep with him. You just have to get him into a hotel room. Just get it to look like you slept with him and then Leave the rest to me. I mean, obviously I thought it sounded batshit. I thought it sounded insane. But then she said... Well, she said she'd give me £1,000. And I thought, yeah, why not? £1,000 for one night's work? Not even that. So I said yes. Awaited further instruction.
What was that?
She told me to get chatting to him outside this pub off Oxford Street. It was that really, really hot weekend in mid-July, remember? When it was like 35 degrees. And I got there and got talking to him, and he was like, yeah, a really nice guy. Him and his mates, sweeties. And he kept talking about how he needed to go home because his wife had promised him a shag. It was like this running joke. And I felt terrible, you know, really bad. I thought, well, I'll do my best, but really, there's only so much I can do. I thought my £1,000 was hanging in the balance, to be honest. But then I just saw him go after his, like, fifth tequila shot. I saw his eyes go. I saw him just sort of go to a different place. And that was when I knew he wasn't going home to shag his wife. Poor woman. Yeah. Poor both of them.
Midday. Alex stands outside Pat's apartment for nearly 10 minutes, ringing and ringing her doorbell over and over again until a neighbour appears at the door of the next flat along and tells her that Pat's not there. That Pat left for Stansted Airport on Saturday morning, that Pat was going on holiday and that, no, he had no idea where to. Spain somewhere, maybe? But did she go with her daughter? Josie? Yes, she was staying here with her, or at least she told me she was. Didn't see Josie leaving with her, says the neighbour. Haven't seen Josie for months. When Pat left the house on Saturday, she was on her own. But if I see Josie around, I'll tell her you were looking for her, shall I? Yes, she replies vaguely. Yes, please. Alex heads straight from Pat's estate to Josie's building on Manor Park Road. She peers through the window but sees no sign of life. It looks exactly as it had looked the last time she was here. The closed laptop still sits on the brown table in the bay. The bed is still neatly made in the bedroom. She notices that there is a side return to the left of Josie's building, blocked by a phalanx of wheelie bins. She moves a couple out of the way and then stands on her tiptoes to peer into the small dirty window that overlooks the return. The curtains are drawn, but there is a small crack through which Alex can see the suggestion of mess and squalor. Piles of clothes and boxes and the corner of an unmade bed. One leg of a scruffy black and red gaming chair. This must be Erin's room, she assumes. The return stinks. The bins are full and it's the tail end of a heatwave. She covers her mouth with her hand and heads back to the pavement. She rings on the doorbell, although she already knows there's nobody there. And then, when nobody comes, she heads home. One very good thing about the vast range of women that Alex has interviewed over the years is the access it gives her to various forms of expertise. She has, on occasion, taken advantage of having certain email addresses in her address book, and now she sits at her laptop and searches for Joanna Defoe, the Deputy Commissioner of the London Metropolitan Police Force, whom she'd had on her podcast a few years earlier and with whom she had bonded over Siberian cats and a habit of eating 4 Weetabix at a time. Joanna, I'm sorry this is so cheeky of me, but my husband has disappeared, and I'm pretty sure he's just sleeping off the mother of all benders somewhere, but I have seen CCTV footage of him being collected by a random car in the middle of the night. Didn't look like an Uber. I have the plates. How easy would it be to find out who the car is registered to? A little later, she goes to collect Leon and Eliza from school. The sun is shining, and there's a cool breeze,
and the atmosphere soft with the fading days of the school year. The promise of the long summer holidays to come just 3 days from now. For a moment, Alex feels as though everything could be normal, that she could go home and see Nathan waiting for her sheepishly in the kitchen. But then a few minutes later, she checks her email, and there is a reply from Joanna Defoe, the Deputy Met Commissioner.
Hi, Alex. Good to hear from you. Sorry you're having a tough time with things. Those plates came back registered to a hire company. The car was rented from them by an Erin Jade Fair on Saturday. Hope that helps. Then please give Skye a snuggle from me.
Alex reads the email twice, three times. Then she pushes her laptop away from her and gasps, her hands over her mouth. Her thoughts jump and crash into each other violently. And then clarity descends, and she picks up her phone and calls the police. I know this might sound insane, she begins, but I think my husband has been kidnapped.
This is DC's Sabrina Albright.
At first, we didn't take it seriously. An estate agent from Queen's Park with a history of disappearing overnight on benders, being kidnapped by a housewife in a hire car in the middle of the night. It just sounded like domestic nonsense, you know, an affair of some kind. Messy people's messy lives. We put it on the back burner. But then, a few hours later, we got the call.
The call?
Yeah, an anonymous call from a payphone in Bristol.
Hi. I need to report a missing person. It's my friend, Erin Fair, and her father, Walter Fair. They live at 43A Manor Park Road, NW6. I haven't heard from them for a long time. Not since, like, over a week ago. And Erin has special needs, and her father is quite elderly. And they usually never leave the house, and I wondered if someone could go and check on them for me. Please. I'm really worried about them.
It took a few hours for us to put the two reports together. The two mentions of the same name in the same day. Erin Fair. And then when we did, it was like, pow. We sent a patrol car down to Manor Park Road and, well, you know exactly what happened after that.
Evening Standard, Tuesday, 23rd of July. A gruesome discovery was made on Monday night in a Kilburn back street. Police and detectives from Kentish Town Police Station went to a flat on the ground floor of a house in Manor Park Road, after receiving an anonymous phone call from a woman in Bristol who was worried about not having heard from her friend for a while. Unable to establish the whereabouts of Erin Fair and her father, and after talking to neighbours who told of loud screams and shouting late on a Friday night more than a week before, police entered the property by force. Immediately, they were aware of a terrible smell emanating from somewhere in the flat. And a few minutes later, the decomposing remains of Walter Fair, 72, were discovered in the bathtub. He had been badly beaten and left with his arms and legs tied together. Police then found Mr. Fair's daughter, Erin Fair, 23, tied to a wooden child's chair in a storage cupboard in the hallway. The chair had been customized with leather straps and leg ties. She too had been beaten and was at first assumed to be dead, but after showing signs of life, was rushed to hospital, where she is now in intensive care, in a coma. According to neighbours, the Fair family had not been seen for a while, and Josie Fair, Walter's wife, has not been traced since the discovery was made. Police are currently investigating her disappearance, and also the disappearance of local man Nathan Summer, who was loosely acquainted with the Fair family, and who was last seen outside a hotel in central London in the early hours of Sunday morning, getting into a car hired using a card held by Mrs. Fair's daughter, Erin. Mr. Summer's wife, the popular podcaster Alex Summer, had recently been recording a podcast with Josie Fair, and Mrs. Fair had been a house guest with the Summers for a week prior to Mr. Summer's disappearance, claiming to have been a victim of domestic abuse at the hands of her husband. Neighbors say that the Fair family kept themselves to themselves and were generally very quiet.
Wednesday, 24th of July. Alex collects the children from school. It's the last day of term tomorrow, and they appear outside the playground, weighed down with old projects, exercise books, and pieces of art, which Alex takes from them while they chatter and play fight each other. Mothers approach and touch her arm gently, ask her if she's okay. She smiles tightly and nods. She's not okay. She really is not okay. There has been no helpful response to the press reports. No sightings of the hire car. No sightings of Nathan. No sightings of Josie. Erin's card has not been used again. Caitlin has not come forward. Nobody who knows Caitlin has come forward, even though the image of her taken from the hotel's CCTV with the large scratch down her cheek has been widely disseminated. The drops of blood found on the floor of the hotel off Tottenham Court Road have been sent off for testing, and the police are currently trying to trace the sender of some messages found on Erin's laptop. They are targeting dog owners and dog shelters, asking them to keep their eyes peeled for pompchies. They are looking at CCTV footage from the cashpoint machines used by whoever has been using Erin's debit card to empty her account of nearly £10,000 in cash since last week. They are looking at CCTV of Manor Park Road to see if Josie has been seen in the area since she left in the middle of the night almost 2 weeks ago, and they have traced the passengers of the six buses that passed the Fairs home between 11 p.m. and 3 a.m. on the night that Josie claims to have been beaten by Walter, to see if any of them saw anything through the window. They have traced people that Erin had been messaging in the days and weeks before her disappearance. They have been in touch with Walter's two sons from his first marriage, who are in Canada, and they have been in touch with Josie's employers and colleagues. But it has now been nearly 4 days since Josie stole Nathan from outside the hotel off Tottenham Court Road, and there is nothing. Not one thing. Until now. As Alex puts the key into the lock of her front door, her phone rings. It is DC Sabrina Albright. I wonder if we might be able to get you along to the station at some point to see me and my colleague, DC Bryant. At your convenience. We have found some objects in the Fair's property, a strange selection of things, including the edition of the Interiors magazine you mentioned you'd seen Mrs. Fair remove from your recycling box while you were out, and something else, something that, well, if you were able to come along and cast your eye, see if you recognise anything else. I can be there now, just... She glances around at her two children, still in their school uniforms, kicking off their shoes in the hallway, and thinks how long it would take for her mother to drive there from Harrow, and says, "Give me an hour. I'll be there in an hour." On the table in front of Alex lies an espresso pod, a bottle of the expensive hand soap that she uses in her guest WC, her bracelet with the little hanging crystals that Nathan had given her for her birthday, a receipt from the organic supermarket dated Alex's birthday, the Interiors magazine, a shiny teaspoon, a card from Alex's kitchen wall that Eliza had made for her 3 years ago after Teeny the dog died, and a strip of passport photographs of Leon. She feels her mouth turn sour at the sight of these tiny, vital, intensely personal parts of her family ephemera on the cold institutional tabletop. But there are other things too, on the table in front of Alex. There is a photograph of two tiny children sitting one on each knee of a young girl, all three children beaming into the camera. There is a hair scrunchie made of pink satin. There is a rubberized phone case with gems arranged into flowers glued to the back. There is an empty Hubba Bubba container. There is a single silver earring with a crucifix hanging from it. There is a scrunched-up paper napkin with pink smudges on it, and a large silk flower attached to a circle of elastic. She shakes her head and says, "These aren't mine." "I don't know. I mean, I assume they belong to her girls. But this..." Her eyes go to the photo of the young girl with the toddlers on her knees. "This isn't Erin or Roxy, but the girl, she looks familiar. She looks..." Alex trawls in her mind for the place in her life where she has seen this face before. And then she gets it, and she points at the photo as her heart gallops under her ribs and says, "Brooke Ripley. That's Brooke Ripley, isn't it? Look." And I remember Josie said Brooke had two small siblings, her half-brother and sister. And that... Hold on. She grabs her phone from her bag and runs a search for Brooke Ripley on Facebook. There. She shows it to Chris Bryant and Sabrina. "Look. It's her. And..." Her eye goes to a detail on the prom night photo of Brooke that she had not noticed before. A large white flower attached to her wrist. Her throat burns dry, and she clutches her stomach subconsciously with her left hand. "Look," she says, her eyes going from the photo to the flower and then to the two detectives. "Look." The detectives stare at the items and the photo on Alex's phone, and a chill permeates the warm office. "There's a key," she finds herself telling Sabrina. "Josie left it under the mattress in my spare room. It has blood on it." "Describe the key," Sabrina says to Alex. "It's small, gold, I think, or brass, a single key. There's a plastic tag attached, one of those that comes as part of a multipack, with the clear plastic window, with the number 6 on it. Just that. I have it at home. I can give it to you. I'm sorry. I should have given it to you before. I didn't think..." "Please, don't worry. You are being incredibly helpful. And this..." Sabrina gestures at the silk wrist corsage, the photograph of Brooke Ripley with her two young siblings. "This could be very important. We will be doubling up our attempts to find Brooke's family. And in the meanwhile, please just take care of yourself and your family. We'll call you when we have anything more to share." Alex gets up to leave, and then stops when she remembers something that's been nagging at her for days. "Was that all?" she asks the detective. "There wasn't a necklace with a golden bumblebee pendant?" "No," says Sabrina. "Not that I'm aware of. But if it turns up, I'll let you know." "Thank you," says Alex, her fingers going instinctively to her clavicle where the pendant used to hang. "That would be great." Alex's mother looks up from the kitchen table where she is sitting with Leon when she hears Alex close the front door behind her half an hour later. She throws her a look and says, "Well?" Alex shakes her head, just perceptibly, and busies herself for a moment putting things in the dishwasher, plugging in her phone to charge, wiping cat hair off the hob. When she's done, she gestures at her mother to join her in the garden. They sit side by side, staring down the garden towards the back wall. The bright evening light glints gold off the windows of Alex's recording studio, and for a moment, she wonders if she will ever again sit behind the sound desk, ever again take pure, focused interest in somebody else's life. "So?" her mother says after a short moment. "Nothing," says Alex. "They have nothing. But..." She shivers slightly as she recalls the unpleasantness of seeing those tiny pieces of her life, her home, her family, laid out in front of her, pulled from the depths of, apparently, Josie's underwear drawer. The thought of Eliza's precious drawing of her with Teenie, Alex's just-departed dog, and Leon's slightly startled-looking four-year-old face nestling in amongst Josie's sad, faded underwear makes her feel nauseous. They found some items in one of her drawers. Some stuff belonging to me. Things she'd stolen from the house. Nothing valuable, just bits. Her voice cracks, and she clutches her mother's hand inside hers and feels her mother's squeeze back hard. She doesn't tell her mother about the corsage, about Brooke Ripley, about the blood-smeared key hidden under Josie's mattress. She just holds her hand and stares into the middle distance, holding back the tears that threaten to overwhelm her. "He'll show up," her mother says softly. "I know he will. I can feel him. He's out there. I reckon he'll be home by the weekend." And it's just what Alex wants to hear. She wants to think that she too can feel him out there. She wants to feel certain that he will walk in through the door this weekend, that he will have a tale to tell her over wine, that they will curl up together in bed, his body maybe smaller, thinner, his arms around her, desperate with the relief of being home, that they will wait. Wait to talk about Caitlin. Wait to talk about the hotel room. They will heal, come together, love. And then they will fix whatever was so broken that Nathan ended up in a hotel room with a girl called Caitlin in the first place. She wants that ending to this story. And she kisses her mother gently on her cheek and says, "Thank you. Yes, thank you."
So Nathan was still going on and on about wanting to go home and have sex with his wife, even though he could hardly put one foot in front of the other. We ended up in a bar in Soho, and I could tell his mates were fading a bit, getting restless. It was so hot that night, and I mean, they weren't young, you know. But he kept wanting one more drink. So I said, "Listen, why don't you guys go? Leave him with me. I can get him home." And then they left, and I told Nathan I would get him home, but first we should have something to eat to sober him up. And I took him to the hotel that Josie had told me to get him to. She said there was a room there booked under Nathan's name, all paid for. Just had to check him in. Easier said than done. Could barely keep him upright. Had to sort of prop him up while I did all the business. He kept saying, "Where's Alex? Is she here? Is she here?" And I said, "Yeah, she's upstairs waiting for you. Come on, sweetie, let's get you up there." And then we got into the room and he said he was hungry. So I got us a McDonald's delivery. We ate that. He drank all the miniatures. All the time he just kept saying, "Where's Alex? Is she coming? Is she coming?" I said, "Yeah, she's coming. She's in an Uber. She'll be here soon." And then, well, he tried to leave. Yeah. That was bad. And I was just like watching my phone for a message from Josie telling me that she was coming, and I was calling her and calling her, and I'd locked the door and was standing in front of it. He was going nuts. "Let me go, just let me go." And then he started throwing stuff about, knocking stuff over. It didn't touch me though, but he accidentally caught me on my cheek with the edge of something sharp. And I was like trapped in this room with this total nutter losing his shit big time, and Josie was not answering. And then finally at about 3 o'clock in the morning she called. She said, "Send him out. Tell him Alex is out there in a black Kia, reg plate, blah, whatever it was." So I unlocked the door, let him go. Dropped some underwear on the floor in the bathroom. Sprayed my perfume all about the place. Messed up the bed. Left. 10 minutes later, £1,000 landed in my PayPal. And that, I assumed, was that. Jesus Christ. I couldn't have been more wrong about that, could I?
Thursday, 25th of July. Alex's mother spends the night. She comes with Alex the following day to the end-of-term assembly in the overwarm school hall, where the doors are standing open but no cool air is getting in. They sit side by side on a bench, their knees bent up into sharp angles. And Alex knows that her mother, though young for her age, will be glad when it is over and she can stretch her legs again. It is the end of primary school for Eliza. In the world in which she lived before Saturday night, this had been the day that Alex had been feeling most anxious about. The end of an era. The end of the safety net of a kind, nurturing primary school. No more sky blue polo shirts for Eliza. No more Velcro fastening book bag. No more assemblies for Alex to join in. No more museum trips for her to accompany. And then it is over. The school spills out. The sun is shining. The summer has begun. 6 weeks of innocence and freedom and the beginning of a new stage of her daughter's life, and she feels none of it. They go to the park and queue for ice creams. The children play with their friends. Alex sits with her mother, away from the other parents. They head home, and Alex puts the children's uniforms in the washing machine for the last time until September. She waits as long as she can, which turns out to be 4:58 p.m. And then she pours wine for herself and her mother. And then, as she glances at her empty glass and considers the possibility of pouring herself another one, even though it's not yet 5:30, her phone rings, and it's Sabrina Albright.
Guess who's just walked into the station, Alex, and wants to see you.
Roxy Fair is the daughter of Josie and Walter Fair.
"2:50 p.m. Roxy picks at the skin around her fingernails and stares at the clock on the wall. She is about to find out what the hell is going on, if anyone would ever actually come and see her. A few minutes later, the door opens and a pair of feds walk in, a man and a woman. Chris and Sabrina, they're called, and they smile and say how sorry they are about Roxy's dad, and then they clear their throats and open notepads, and the woman says, "Do you know where your mother is, Roxy?" Roxy shakes her head. "I haven't seen her since I was 16. "We've managed to get hold of your grandmother, Pat O'Neill." Roxy nods. "She's in Menorca, but she's heading back tomorrow. She says you'll be able to stay with her if you want." "I can't stay. I have work. I need to get back." "Okay, that's fine. But you should know, if you haven't already seen it in the news, that we are actively searching for your mother in relation to your father's murder and the attempted murder of Erin." Roxy flicks a gaze at the female police detective and then at the male. "Seriously?" "Yes. There's a lot going on at the moment, Roxy. And I think it might be best to talk you through it a step at a time, so it doesn't get too confusing. Is that okay?" Roxy nods tightly. "It sounds as if your mum and dad had a row on the night of Friday the 12th of July. They'd been for dinner at a friend's house." Roxy interjects with a snort of laughter. "Yeah, right. A woman called Alex Summer had recently befriended your mother. They'd been working on some kind of project together for a few weeks. This culminated in a dinner invitation on that Friday night. A few hours after your mother and father left Mrs. Summer's house, your mother reappeared on Mrs. Summers' doorstep badly injured, claiming to have been beaten by your father. My father? Yes. That is what she told Mrs. Summer. She told Mrs. Summer that she and Erin had left the flat together in the early hours of the morning, and implied that your father was alive and well. She then spent a week living at Mrs. Summer's house, before leaving on Saturday morning, telling Mrs. Summer that she was going to her mother's flat. Your grandma, Pat. The same night, Mrs. Summer's husband disappeared, after a night out in town drinking with friends. The two events would seem to be entirely unrelated, apart from the fact that the hotel room that Mrs. Summer's husband was staying in when he disappeared, and the car that was filmed collecting him from the hotel he was staying at, were both paid for by a debit card in the name of... The woman pauses, and Roxy stares at her as if to say, "Well, go on then. Erin Fair." "What? Sorry. My sister, who is currently in a coma, paid for a hotel room for some random guy." "We don't think it was your sister, Roxy. We think your mother has been using your sister's card. And here's the thing. We've been investigating your sister's bank account and, well, there had been a remarkable amount of money in there. Over £40,000. And in the last 2 weeks, over 10,000 of those pounds have been taken out from cashpoint machines in Queen's Park. And according to what your mother told Mrs. Summer, your sister, Erin, had special needs. She ate baby food and didn't leave the house, and yet she had money coming into her bank account on a daily basis. All from a live streaming company called Glitch. Do you know anything about this aspect of your sister's life?" "Yeah, she's famous." "Famous for what?" "Gaming. People pay a subscription fee to Glitch, and then they get to watch players online. And my sister is one of the best." "So she earns money playing video games." Roxy can't believe how old some people sound, like they live in a different world to her. But she controls the urge to roll her eyes, and she says, "Yeah, that's right. So, both detectives adjust their sitting positions. The man stares at his paperwork. The woman glances up at Roxy. "Where do you think your mother might be?" Roxy lets out a rasp of laughter. "You're asking me that?" "Well, yes. Not going to be able to help you, I'm afraid. My mother..." Roxy stops, her spiky facade slipping for just a moment. "My mother hated me. My mother hated my father. My mother hates my sister. She's obviously taken Erin's money to start a new life without any of us in it. But is there anything in particular? A place that meant something to her? Mrs. Summer suggests that your mother was very nostalgic about the early days of family life. Overly so, maybe. So was there somewhere you went as a family, maybe?" Roxy shrugs. She doesn't see her childhood in that way. There's no golden glow emanating from any area of it. "We used to go to the Lake District every summer. For a week. I hated it. All of us stuck in a caravan. Or some hairy cabin with, like, spiders everywhere. But she loved it. She used to drink wine every night and go on and on about the views." "Can you remember whereabouts in the Lake District you used to go?" "Yes. Ambleside. Right by the water." Roxy watches them write this down. She narrows her eyes at them and says, "You know there's no way my dad ever laid a finger on my mum, don't you?" "Well, we do have photographic evidence that shows your mum's injuries." "How?" "Mrs. Summer took them. Last week. Roxy sighs and tuts. Sorry, Mrs. Summer. Mrs. Summer. Who the hell is this Mrs. Summer? She's your mother's friend. But my mother doesn't have any friends. She's a friend, but she's also been making a podcast with her. A podcast? What sort of podcast? She was interviewing your mother about her life. Roxy can't help but laugh.
Seriously?
Yes. We've listened to the recordings. They're quite harrowing. In what way? Your childhood. The abuse. What happened to your friend, Brooke? Brooke? Her heart turns black for a moment. Her stomach churns. The detectives exchange a look. Yes, Brooke Ripley. She was your friend from school. She had a relationship with your father. Had a relationship with my... She went missing, you know, about the same time you left home. And we're investigating the possibility that her disappearance might have been related to your parents. You're joking, right? No, we're not joking. We're acting on the testimony left by your mother on Mrs. Summer's podcast recording. Roxy shakes her head and closes her eyes. Listen, I can't deal with this, okay? What else did my mum say to this woman? She shared hours of testimony with her, all of which pointed towards a very toxic domestic situation in your home, towards the possibility of spousal and child abuse, including the alleged sexual abuse of your sister. The woman stops, licks her lips, touches the paperwork with her peach fingertips. By your father. My... Roxy slams her hands down on the tabletop and the two detectives jump slightly. Seriously? My dad? That's what my mum told her, is it? She said that your father left the marital bed every night and went into Erin's bedroom, then didn't come back. Yes, he was gaming with her. Gaming? Yes. He was part of the thing. Part of the act, you know? The subscribers loved my dad being there. He would just sit behind her and make wisecracks. He had a nickname. Pops. Erased and Pops. That was part of why her stream was so popular. Because of him. So why do you think he didn't tell your mother about it? She just couldn't. Could not deal with anything he had to do with either of us. She was so jealous of him, of the fact that we loved him. She was sick with it, you know? Sick in the head. So tell me, please. I can take it. Tell me what she did to him. Tell me what my mum did to my dad. Roxy sits outside the Chi Chi coffee shop on Salisbury Road. Her brain is on fire. It's hot with things, with thoughts rolling and jostling, and images flashing and pounding. And she acts like she doesn't care. She acts like she's seen it all before. But she hasn't. And her dad is fucking dead. And Erin is attached to 1,000 wires in a hospital room. Her life still hanging in the balance. She shreds a paper napkin with tense fingers, then realises what she's done and balls the shreds together tightly. She glances up through the plate glass and sees a woman walking hurriedly towards the shop. She's tall and her hair is very blonde. It looks natural, but Roxy can see the roots starting to grow back in her side parting. She is wearing flared jeans and a sweatshirt, stack-heeled trainers and no makeup. She looks like she hasn't slept for days. She sees Roxy as she enters the cafe and looks at her questioningly. Roxy nods. Hi, Roxy. She sits down. God, this is... She seems lost for words, and her eyes scan Roxy's face as though she's trying to remember it for later. I can't believe it's you. I just feel like... Her hands go up in the air and flutter around vaguely before landing in her lap. Are you okay? Roxy nods. Roxy is always okay, and would never want anyone to think otherwise. I'm really sorry about your father. Roxy nods again. Then she looks at Alex and says, What did my mum tell you about my dad? Alex eyes her uncertainly and then says, I'm not sure how true a lot of it was. Just tell me. So Alex does.
3 p.m. Is that comfortable? Alex looks across the desk in her recording studio at Roxy, who is adjusting her headphones. Roxy nods and gives her a thumbs up. Great. Roxy is 5 foot tall and terrifying. Her jaw juts defiantly, even when she's being pleasant. This is all bullshit, she'd said in the cafe just now, loud enough for the two young mums sitting behind to pause their conversation and turn slightly in their seats. I can't believe she told you that stuff. It's... And she'd been about to launch into her own telling of her childhood when Alex put her hand up to stop her. How would you feel, she said, about contributing to the podcast? Telling your side? When? Roxy asked. Now? I live just up there, 2 minutes away, less. She'd expected Roxy to say no, to be cagey and private and prickly. But she'd immediately picked up her small rucksack and started to stand up. Is this going to be like a true crime podcast then? She asked. And Alex had felt a shiver run through her at the realization that somehow, through the stultifying fog of fear and dread, it had escaped her that that's exactly what she was now doing. She was making a true crime podcast out of the events of her own life. Now she plays Roxy a small part of one of Josie's recordings. It's from the day that Josie told her about Brooke. She watches Roxy's face as she listens, the looks of confusion and incredulity that pass across her fine features. She shakes her head occasionally, as if trying to dislodge something from her ear. Alex presses pause and waits for Roxy to speak.
Over the next 24 hours, Alex Summer recorded nearly 4 hours of testimony from Roxy Fair.
Brooke Ripley started late at my school. Everyone hated her. I remember being glad because it took the spotlight off me for a moment. She was kind of pretty. Looked older than 14, big boobs. And we sort of paired off just because everyone hated us. And yeah, she and I got quite close. Really close, in fact. Brooke and I ended up being, like, together, you know? I'd always known I was gay from a really young age. But Brooke was my first girlfriend. And it was seriously intense for a while. We were really in love. Didn't tell anyone about it. Only Erin. But not Mum. Not Dad. And I remember this time, it was Christmas. My dad was home. Yeah, I remember that now. He was baking cookies in his Christmas apron. We were listening to Christmas music. It was kind of nice. Felt like a normal family for once.
Were you not a normal family?
No. We were not a normal family. Not by any stretch. But right then, in that moment, it felt normal. And my dad was laughing and joking. And I looked at Brooke and I thought, I bet you wish your dad was like mine. I remember thinking that. I remember it really clearly. I felt proud, you know? And yes, of course, my mum hated it. Hated seeing us all having a laugh, all being happy. Afterwards, Brooke said something like, I think your mum hates me. I said, why do you say that? And she said, I don't know, the vibes I was getting off her. I think mum just really resented her because she could tell how much I liked her. How much we all liked her. She could tell that Brooke was more important to me than her. That I loved her. You know, and she couldn't deal with it. She couldn't deal with anything that wasn't about her. She was sick with envy.
And then there was a fight. According to witnesses, you and Brooke had a physical fight on school premises towards the end of your last term of school.
Yeah, she, or at least, I thought she'd said something about Erin. Someone told me she'd used a derogatory word about her. So I just went in, like I do. Stupid. No fact-checking. And lamped her. School suspended me, even though I was about to start my exams. I was kind of impetuous when I was young. I was kind of a nightmare, to be honest. And that was it for me in school. I was done with it. I was done with all of it. But mainly I was done with my mother. So I ran away from home. I wanted Brooke to come with me. She said she wasn't ready. She wanted to do her GCSEs. She wanted to go to the stupid fucking prom. She wanted to do it all properly. So I just went without her. Hoped she'd come to her senses. Hoped she'd come and find me. But instead she just went and disappeared. Into thin air. And that was that.
So you running away from home, it was nothing to do with your father and Brooke. There was nothing going on. Erin didn't tell you she'd heard them having sex. None of that actually happened.
I've never heard so much bullshit in my life.
...11 p.m. Roxy sleeps in Alex's spare bedroom that night. Despite her coarse bravado, Alex senses the soft child beneath. The 16-year-old girl living in a toxic environment who just needed someone to nurture her. As Alex shows her to her room, she explains that this is where her mother had slept for a week, just before she disappeared. She had this key, hidden under her mattress. It had the number 6 written on it. I gave it to the police, but they couldn't match it with any of the locks in your parents' house. Do you know anything about it? Roxy shrugs. No. You don't have access to an outhouse or a shed or, I don't know, some kind of storage unit? I don't think so. Although, my dad had a garage, I think. His dad kept some old banger in it, I think. I do remember going in there once or twice when we were small. It was all like dusty and cobwebby. Do you remember where it was? Yeah, round the back. Round the back of what? The house. There's this sort of, what's it called, a mews? Like two sets of garages facing each other, about 7 or 8 of them, I guess. And how did you get to this mews from your house? Like out the front and then round the corner and through a gate? But we also had a window in the bathroom that opened up onto it too. Alex and Roxy exchange a look, but neither of them gives voice to their thoughts.
Claire and Georgie Small were holidaymakers at Ambleside Manor Lodge Park.
We were there in July 2019. Me, my mum, my dad, my brothers. We'd just arrived 2 days before, and it was during that heat wave we had back then. It was so hot, even up there by the lakes. We didn't see her come. Just woke up the next morning and she was there. Sort of waved at her across the park, didn't we? She had a little dog with her, and she sort of waved back, but I could see she wasn't friendly. But that was okay. We weren't there to make friends.
The lodges are built for privacy, you see. It's not like an average holiday park where you're all rammed in. The lodges are new, only built a couple of years ago, and they all face out over the lake and have space around them, so you can't see into other people's properties. So, yeah, we knew she was there, but we didn't see much of her. She just sat out on her deck at night with a glass of wine, staring across the lake at sunset. I raised a glass to her once. She raised hers back at me. But that was as far as any interaction went. Then one day, about 3 or 4 days after she arrived, she wasn't there anymore. She just upped and left. But the car was still there. Thought that was strange. But didn't think a lot about it after that. We stayed for 10 days, all told. And it was on our last day that the police arrived in Ambleside.
Just unbelievable that we've been there all those days. Just hanging out, drinking, doing water sports, admiring the views, having fun, living our best lives when all along... I mean, what's the matter with people? Seriously, what the hell is the matter with some people?